Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, the only streaming club that's critically acclaimed streaming club. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic, and this is our inaugural spinoff episode.
Yeah.
The Streaming Club was part of Critically Acclaimed, the main new film release, film review podcast that we had. And when the pandemic hit and everybody was inside, we decided to expand our horizons into what people are watching at home.
Yeah.
And go into the streaming services that were going neglected in favor of our new film releases.
Well, basically what happened was for the majority of the pandemic, most films that were, even the ones that were released in theaters, were also being released on video on demand. So the majority of people were watching movies at home, and it seemed weird to only watch new releases at home. So we wanted to remind people that while you're watching, I don't know, whatever was on, Mortal Kombat, Wonder Woman 1984, whatever was on Netflix last year, I don't even remember. while you're watching all of that, there's also a lot of old movies that are on those streaming services, many of which we haven't seen before, or you haven't seen before. And so we decided to leave it up to our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Every one of our patrons, even at $1 a month, gets to vote for an episode of the Streaming Club. Every week, we present four films from a particular category or decade or a filmmaker on a particular streaming service, and that varies from week to week. We each pick two films. Whitney picks two, and I pick two. And the only rule is they have to meet that criteria, they have to be on that streaming service, and we can't have seen them before, or maybe we saw them when we were a little kid and we barely remember them. Like, we'll cut a little slack for that. So it's two Whitney hasn't seen, two I haven't seen. Sometimes there's overlap and neither of us have seen it. Our patrons vote for it. And it was a successful segment. People liked it. People talked about it. And we realized that now that cinema is, you know, coming back in full force in theaters, and films like A Quiet Place are actually making quite a lot of money, the system might change a little bit, and so we felt that the Streaming Club deserved its own show.
I've liked doing it because it's given us an excuse to catch up on the films we've always kind of meant to, that are readily available, and we've watched a lot of great films because of this.
And also some real turkeys, and that's fine too. And
But popular ones, so we're at least more conversant in some of these notorious stinkers.
Winnie and I are film critics. We've been professional film critics for at least 10 years each, and we watched a lot of movies. We've watched a lot of classic movies. We've watched a lot of international movies, mainstream movies, franchise films. But nobody has time to see everything. Like, nobody. I don't care who they are. You could have been around since the dawn of cinema. You wouldn't have had the time. So we're always playing a little bit of catch-up. No matter how much you think you know about something, there's always more to learn. Yeah. And this is a great opportunity for us to, you know, a lot of the stuff that we talk about, if it's not a brand new release, is stuff that we've seen a bunch. You know, we could talk about Citizen Kane till the cows came home. We've seen it a bunch of times. I love it. I'll happily talk about it again, but we want that sense of discovery. For a long time, there were a lot of older movies that I didn't see kind of on purpose, just because I wanted to eventually have something that I hadn't seen that I had heard good things about, and have that sense of discovering an old classic, because I hear people talking about, like, oh, yeah, I just saw The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 for the very first time. And I'm like, oh, you're so lucky. Watching that movie for the very first time is such a great sense of discovery. And so, yeah, we get this every week. And our patrons get to be involved and help curate the films that we pick. And this first episode of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club proper is a bit of an aberration. We're really only going to do one a week, but this time we had a vote. And the vote was for family films on the streaming service Tubi, which is a free streaming service. It has ads, but they're not terribly obtrusive. And it actually has a pretty good back catalog of older esoteric cult films. So we decided to make the first one about family films on Tubi. Whitney picked two. I picked two. And it ended up being a tie on the first poll between the film I picked, one of the films I picked and one of the films he picked. It was a tie between Troop Beverly Hills and A Gnome Named Gnorm. So we had a runoff between just those two titles, and it was a tie between Troop Beverly Hills and A Gnome Named Gnorm. Some of our patrons were given like slightly different readouts. The one said like one got like 49%, the other one got 51%. But on our back end, it was a tie. So we decided that even if maybe somehow there's a glitch in the system and one film got one more vote, clearly people wanted these films equally. So we're going to do both.
Yeah.
And just to make it fun. So Whitney, where would you like to start on the first Streaming Club episode?
Oh golly, where to start? Well, why don't we start with the good one? That is to say, Troop Beverly Hills.
Yay!
Phyllis Neffler's life was a symphony of spending.
This one. Out. I'll take the rest.
I started my new meaningful life today, and I bought a whole new meaningful wardrobe to go with it.
Until her husband stopped the music.
You never give me an ounce of credit for anything I do.
That's because you never do anything!
Well, then I guess I'm going to do something right now.
Approve!
Mom's gonna be our new troop leader.
Who are you?!
Phyllis Neffler, Troop Beverly Hills.
Now, she's changing her style.
Well, girls, are you ready to rough it?
From Rodeo Drive.
I can't let you take the girls out there alone.
Why not?
Because you get lost in your walk-in closet.
To Cookie Drive.
That jamboree thing sounds fabulous.
My troop is definitely going. What is a jamboree?
Cool!
Now, that said, Troop Beverly Hills is not a great movie with a capital G.
Get out of my apartment. Yeah, I've invited you to my apartment so many times. You're like, out of here. You're gone. I have a framed poster of Troop Beverly Hills.
And I went to your wedding, and you played the song from Troop Beverly Hills at your wedding.
Yes, we did. I understand. Not at the after party. During the ceremony. It was that important to us.
That was the exit song.
Yeah. Specifically, the Beach Boys song, Make It Big, which plays over the credits of Troop Beverly Hills, and it's an animated sequence which... weirdly, there's a lot of weird history here, was animated by John Kay, the creator of Ren and Stimpy, who would go on to be revealed to be a massive creep.
Yeah, my response was, oh, look, John Kay. Oh, right, John Kay. John Kay has done some pretty unsavory things.
Some extremely unsavory things. I think you're underplaying it. It's really gross.
But he is also the creator of the Ren and Stimpy show, so he's like... also an important figure in animation, so there's all this ambivalence about like his importance as an artist and his unsavory character.
I wouldn't say it's ambivalence. I just think it's difficult to acknowledge that both things are true.
It's a balance. Like, yeah, both things are true.
We want nothing to do with him, but he clearly had an enormous influence on animation as we know it, and that's weird.
He did an opening animated sequence in that Spumco style, just sort of laying out some of the character of what the movie we're about
the
to see.
Antics, if you will.
There you go. The anticking that's going to go on.
Yeah.
The story is about Shelley Long. She plays a rich Beverly Hills housewife.
Mm-hmm. She described herself as a trophy wife. Yeah. Like that was her day job.
That's not disparaging. That is her own description of herself. And her marriage is about to end with Craig T. Nelson. Craig T. Nelson has made a fortune being a mascot for a muffler company. He dresses in a muffler outfit. We see him on TV.
And it's important to remember, this is the late 1980s. Mm. These are good gets. Shelley Long was off of Cheers, which is one of the biggest sitcoms ever. Craig T. Nelson was Coach on yet, or had just about to premiere?
I think Coach was running at the same time as this.
It's about the same time.
It's about 89. So these are big sitcom stars. They got their own movie. And... like I said, their marriage is on the outs, and she's always been a little bit embarrassed by the way he's made his money. Because it's not a dignified way to make money, being a pitch man for a company, but sure is lucrative.
They have a very, very fancy mansion in Beverly Hills, which if you don't know, it's a very swank neighborhood in Los Angeles. Like, it's
one of the most expensive zip codes in the entire world.
Yeah, and... It's really interesting how this movie begins, actually, because you've got this opening animation sequence, which is in a vacuum, at least, nicely animated, looks like it'd be a good kids' TV show, and then it opens with just a meeting of the Wilderness Girls, because the Girl Scouts didn't want to put their name on this.
Well, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts are copywritten. If you want to use them,
you need to get their permission.
You have to get their permission, and you probably have to pay a good deal. Mm-hmm. And
they almost never give their permission.
Well, they're the types of institutions that don't want a license. They're just sort of their own thing.
Well, they're also very protective of their image, and so if there's anything even remotely untoward, they tend not to allow it. Yeah, so there's always like some fake version of it. And so here it's the Wilderness Girls instead of the Girl Scouts, but it's clearly the Girl Scouts. And we start off at a Wilderness Girls meeting, and they just basically say, yeah, so there's a Troop Beverly Hills, and it needs a Scoutmaster, and I guess it's going to be Shelley Long now. And it's like, we're just skipping the inciting incident entirely. Mm. We are just getting started right away. There's no point wasting 20 minutes getting to the point where Shelley Long agrees to be a Girl Scout leader. We're already there.
Yeah, that's modern screenwriting. There would be 20 full minutes of what her life was like leading up to that point, what the troop had gone through before, the incident. We would have witnessed the incident that got the previous Scoutmaster fired.
I've often wondered if there was like deleted footage or just an early draft or that was in there and some genius filmmaker decided to cut it all out.
Here's what I'm guessing. I think screenwriting has just changed, and they're quicker on the gun back in 1989. They were able to get to the meat of the story a lot faster. It doesn't really matter how that Scoutmaster got fired or Shelley Long's entire life leading up to that point. What they do have is a big fight between Shelley Long and Craig T. Nelson about the state of their marriage and how they've kind of lost faith in each other. They also have a daughter, played by Jenny Lewis.
And how do we know Jenny Lewis?
Jenny Lewis is a big star. She was in a lot of films as a kid. Mm-hmm. And she's also what is her band?
Is it Rilo Kiley?
I think it's Rilo Kiley. Yeah. Yeah. She's also like an indie music. Yeah.
Rilo Kiley, not just a Sith Lord, also a very, very popular indie band, which was headlined by Jenny Lewis.
Jenny Lewis, yeah.
Who was also, I believe she was also in The Wizard. Am I?
She was. She was. Yeah. She was the lead, female lead in The Wizard.
Yeah. So
opposite Fred Savage.
So she's in this Wilderness Girls troop, and they need a new troop leader, and Shelley Long has agreed to do it, and Craig Nelson basically just says, this is going to be hilarious, you never finish anything. And they have a really big fight, and I actually really like this fight at the beginning of the movie, because even though there's going to be a lot of silliness later, the fight is actually about genuine relationship stuff. And he's mad because he feels like he does all the work in the relationship, and all she does is spend and worry about their image. And she talks about how, hey, listen, I actually scrimped and saved to help put you through law school because that was your dream, and then you ended up doing this instead. And now my job was to be your trophy wife, and I did that for you. And it sounds, it's one of those arguments where they're clearly both in the wrong. This is not like just one of them is a bad person. This is a relationship that had expectations, and at some point they crossed paths, and they just missed each other, and they're no longer on the same page. And I buy that. I buy them.
But it doesn't really track, though, that she sort of was there for him the whole time and scrimped and saved, and they once lived in poverty and now they're rich. Because she's clearly written as if she's old money and was raised in wealth, because she's a little bit clueless as to the way the world works now.
Maybe.
She's become so blinded by her wealth that she's sort of lost contact with the rest of the world.
Or because maybe she was rich and she married a guy who wasn't rich, and then she made sacrifices for him, and now they're rich again.
But the joke of the movie is that the Wilderness Girls, the Girl Scouts, are a little bit more about roughing it. They're about wilderness survival. They're a little bit more nature-oriented and a little bit more geared toward learning and building, using your own wits within the natural world.
Survival skills.
Survival skills. And Shelley Long is very urbane. She's very, she lives in the big city and doesn't know anything about that. And the big juxtaposition of putting this rich, clean makeup and hairdo-coated socialite in the wilderness, comedy would ensue.
Yeah. And honestly, pretty good setup.
It's a pretty good setup, and I'm glad they didn't necessarily go down the path of, oh no, I have a squirrel in my hair kind of jokes, where it's just sort of like shaming her, because she's actually a very bubbly, good-hearted person. And the film I was reminded of was actually Cold Comfort Farm, a film from the mid-90s that I'm very fond of with Kate Beckinsale, which is about a rich socialite who doesn't have any experience living in the country, going to live with some hayseed family members, distant hayseed family members, out on their mud farm. It's just this filthy, horrible place, and everybody's miserable there. Cold Comfort Farm. And there's like a crazed grandmother who lives in the attic and always talks about, oh, the farm is cursed when we see her at all. And there's all these like country bumpkins who have no ideas to like the way the world works. Like, why do I keep having children? I don't know how it works. And she, rather than it being about the country people using their down-home earthiness to teach her a lesson, which would be the American story, it's about her taking her upper-class wealth and cleaning things up around the farm.
Yeah.
And then going back to the city. It's about her using her intuition from the city to clean up something that is very kind of low class. So yeah. The upper class enlightening the lower classes.
It's kind of the opposite of Capra-esque. And
exactly.
And yet it has that very wholesome, charming quality, and so it ultimately feels a little Capra-esque anyway.
Yeah. But that's a British movie. This is an American film that does the same thing, and it feels really backwards.
Yeah.
Because it is about Shelley Long using her wealth and connections and limited knowledge of how to traverse the streets of Beverly Hills, specifically, to teach these girls life lessons. And of course, at the end of the film, we learn there's life lessons that can be found just about anywhere.
Yeah, where you were born.
Ultimately pretty positive.
Where you were born and what social stratus you were raised in doesn't have to prevent you from being a good person. Yeah. And I feel that, you know, the 1980s was an era where wealth had started to become, more so than in previous generations, as near as I can tell, really fetishized for a while.
Robin Leach appears in this movie, and Robin Leach had a program called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Which is basically just look at how rich these people are, the show.
If you think it's really bad now with, like, Instagram influencers constantly photographing and showing off their wealth and comfort, it was way worse in the 80s, to the point where, there were TV shows about, look how wealthy these people are, they have yachts that are coated in gold, and here's a dress that cost them $50,000, and that's 1983 dollars.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to tune into that show and just go, wow, isn't that great?
I wish I had that.
I wish I had that money.
I should work harder at a warehouse where I work, and then I'll get that mansion. Spoiler alert, you won't.
that's not the way wealth works. We're a little bit wiser about wealth.
But
this was in 1989 when we were starting a little bit of a reckoning with our view toward the ultra wealthy.
Well, I think there actually had been in comedies actually throughout the late 70s and the 80s in particular, there started to be this sort of, I've heard it called the slobs versus snobs genre, often typified by Animal House, which is a really gross movie actually, but it was very influential. And it was about how, here are the rich, snooty people. Mm. And then here are the unwashed, the less educated, less well-dressed, less polite, just the hoi polloi, the working class, who will get revenge on the rich and powerful. Yes. And we had a lot of that in the 80s. That was kind of the comedy paradigm, is that the rich were the bad guys by default.
Yeah.
And True Beverly Hills kind of reverses that. And I kind of, and it seems like that would be the kind of thing where you might want to reject it. It'd be like, surely that's a weird message. But what ultimately Troop Beverly Hills ends up being about is the idea that, yes, the fabulously wealthy are living on another planet. Mm. They are indeed part of a completely different environment where there are very different rules and they are completely divorced from a lot of the regular human experience, but they are still human beings, and having a connection to other human beings and learning positive lessons about being in a community and being friends and being self-sustaining is actually really important, because otherwise we get like the Trumps. That's kind of what it boils down to here, is the rich and powerful are people too, and they need to be treated that way in order to become real people.
I listened to a lecture on Hamlet recently about the function of tragedy, and you'll notice in most tragedies, especially Shakespeare's tragedies, the subjects are always of high station. Mm-hmm. They're royals of some sort.
Mostly,
or they're upper class citizens of some sort, and or they're connected to the kings, or they've married into royalty. And it's about how when they start to experience these personal tragedies, the entire kingdom falls apart. There's always a connection to a there's a larger consequences to their own personal failings.
Yeah.
And as such, tragedies are inherently political.
Yeah. This is why, this is why in Beauty and the Beast, like all of the other like people in the castle get turned into stuff too. It's not because they had responsibility for it. It's because where the kingdom goes, there goes its people.
Right.
And they're, those are interconnected.
And something like Troop Beverly Hills, it's not a tragedy. It's a comedy film. Yeah. But this is trying to use the language of comedy to have the ultra rich scrabble towards their connection with humanity.
Yeah.
This is that's the arc of the Shelley Long character.
Yeah.
She is disconnected, and she realizes not that she's disconnected, but that, that humanity is a requisite to live.
Yeah.
And what I and what makes this formula work is she's not actually abusing middle class kids and forcing her viewpoint on them. These are actually ultra wealthy kids who are also disconnected from the world.
Yeah, we've got kids who are the children of famous actors. Mm. We've got kids who are children of plastic surgeons. We've got kids who are children
famous
of
famous athletes, psychiatrists. There's a lot of pop psychology in this where people are repeating a lot of self-esteem platitudes that were really hip in the late 80s.
There's a woman who is clearly... was it Jacqueline Suzanne who wrote all those books?
Jackie Collins.
Jackie Collins, that's something. Who's Jacqueline Suzanne?
She's also an author.
Okay, fair enough. But Jackie Collins is like a Jackie Collins type woman, and her daughter is also an a young actor like on some TV show. And yeah, there's
the daughter is already really famous, and her mom is like Jackie Collins. So the daughter is like helping her write these really salacious sex scenes, like helping her spitball.
And it's actually like, I like the bit. She actually has a good bit that kind of grounds the movie really, really fast, where the daughter says... you know, like mom's like, hey, do you really need to go do this wilderness girl thing? Like it's, Shelley Long's doing it. It's going to be really weird and probably missing the point. And she says, no, I am an actor in Hollywood and I'm a child. I need some connection to humanity. I need friends. I feel weird. Like this is wrong. So we're just solidifying right now. And one kid is the child of a dictator.
Specifically Marcos from the Philippines.
Yeah.
It's a
weird joke.
Yeah. And he shows up and it's clearly,
they
even make a joke about how his wife has too many shoes, which was the joke about Imelda Marcos, Fernando Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos's wife, who was eventually ousted, but was a dictator of the Philippines for many, many years. And he just shows up in his dictator mobile and they call him dictator. Like that's his title.
They never say his last name, but it's very, it's supposed like nowadays we might be far enough removed from that period of history that he's not instantly recognizable. But if at the time he was instantly recognizable.
Now, how do you make this group of unconnected, ultra wealthy children of celebrities and dictators into underdogs? Well, it turns out that Culver City and Mar Vista, which is the neighborhood where we live, have much better scout troops.
Yeah, like much more like really like hardcore survivalist scout troops. And they are led by a woman named Velda Plender, who is played by the great Betty Thomas. Betty Thomas, who had actually accomplished actor, but also directed a lot of great movies. She directed the Brady Bunch movie, which is still surprisingly amazing. She directed Private Parts. She directed the Eddie Murphy Dr. Dolittle, which isn't a great movie, but was a huge, gigantic hit. She directed I Spy and 28 Days. She's very accomplished. And she's very, very funny here.
28 Days... better than it gets credit for.
The Sandra Bullock movie.
It's an alcoholism movie, and it's actually like not great, but weirdly wise in certain ways.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan. I think Betty Thomas is really, really talented, and so she's a very stern taskmaster, and she has absolutely no love nor tolerance for Troop Beverly Hills, who she sees as coming from wealth and privilege and unwilling to do the work. And initially, she's not wrong. They actually go out to do some camping, and Shelley Long's like attendants put up the tents. They have a little buffet. They're instead of like roasting marshmallows, they're doing fondue, which really is just as easy as marshmallows. Like I was watching this, I'm like, why not? Why don't we do fondue?
Fondue was one of those foods in the 80s that was mocked for being a little bit outré, only rich person food. It's like
melted chocolate and or cheese. Like, it's not complicated. You can totally do fondue.
Do you remember that scene in The Breakfast Club where Molly Ringwald says she's eating sushi and they kind of make a face like, what the hell, you're bringing sushi? That's like the weirdest possible thing somebody could have brought to school in 1986.
And I would eat sushi every single day if someone would let me.
Now sushi is so incredibly common. You can get it anywhere, but it was considered like weird rich person food for a little bit.
Yeah.
There was even a joke about that when we talked about The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. There were a lot of like fun anachronistic jokes about this is something that was invented and somebody was inventing sushi on a pier. And one of the characters was like, no one will ever eat this stuff. Oh, no, it's going to be big someday. And that series came out in the mid-90s when sushi was like finally
becoming popular
exploded in the United States. Well, I mean,
it was already
technically
popular.
It
was becoming mainstream in the United States. Yeah.
So fondue is a joke on the rich in Beverly Hills.
So they get caught in the rain and it's really embarrassing and they all say screw it and they end up camping out in a fancy hotel.
The Beverly Hills Hotel.
Yeah. And they tell stories. It's actually a fun counterpoint between the telling spooky stories in Addams Family Values and telling spooky stories in True Beverly Hills. You remember Addams Family Values? It cuts to Wednesday Addams saying, and the next morning, all their old noses had grown back. There's a version of that in True Beverly Hills, but it's about getting a perm.
That's right. My perm had straightened overnight.
No. It was like, he permed me! It's adorable. It turns out that Velda points out that you're not roughing it. You're not actually teaching them anything. You're just hanging out in a hotel room, and that's not the point. She's cruel about it, but her overall point is valid. And so Shelley Long says, okay, I actually need to work at this. I can't teach these kids survival skills that I don't have.
Yeah.
But what I can do is take the skills that I have learned operating within this weird ultra-rich paradigm that I have and try to turn this into something healthy and positive. And so she uses her Beverly Hills skills to teach kids things like how to appraise diamonds, which is an interesting skill. I'm not gonna pretend otherwise. Teaching kids various dances. Dancing is a perfectly valid thing for a merit badge, that kind of thing. They end up like, instead of their version of like helping people across the street is volunteering at an old folks home for wealthy people, but still an old folks home. Yeah, and it's still valid, you know,
handing out magazines. And the gag is, handing out magazines. They can't get anybody interested, but the old man perks up when he starts reading the Penthouse magazine.
Yeah. Just a little inappropriate, but it's handled relatively tactfully.
13-year-old girls have Penthouse magazine.
Yeah.
It was a thing in the 80s. It was
handled as well as that can be, I think. Yeah. It probably wouldn't fly today, but it's going better.
In teaching the young girls these skills, she is reconnecting with humanity, understanding that connecting with other human beings is important.
Craig T. Nelson
begins noticing this, and he starts to drift away from his hot young new girlfriend back toward Shelley Long.
Yeah. It hits like an apex in the middle where one of the most important things of being a quote-unquote wilderness girl, Girl Scouts, is selling cookies. And the Red Feathers, which are the Velda's group, they have little red feathers on their caps, and that's how you can tell them apart from everyone else.
Ooh, from Culver City.
Evil Culver City. They shut down my favorite pho place. Damn them.
Culver City, there used to be a chili joint in Culver City called Tubbs Chili, and they closed it down.
There was a place on Venice called Super Pho that was the absolute best. It was so affordable and so good. It got me through so many rough years, and it closed during the pandemic, and I'm just furious.
Culver City, by the way, is this incredibly weirdly sprawling neighborhood here in Los Angeles, where it's probably best known for being the seat of a lot of local film studios, a lot of the places that aren't
Sony Pictures is over there.
Sony is in Culver City, and a lot of other studios besides. And
it also was for a long time, not so much anymore, but for a long time, it was one of the more affordable areas in Los Angeles.
That's what was really curious about it. It was like this weird mix of high. It was like Venice. It was like some really high rent properties and some really low rent properties. Now there's a huge amount of gentrification going on in Culver City right now. But
there's no low priced apartments in LA anymore. They're gone.
No.
It's horrible.
But yeah, back in 1989, Culver City was not a rich neighborhood.
No. The Veldas Group is going to sell, I think it was, they're going to sell 1,000 boxes. And I was just like, oh, shit. They got this. They got this in the bag. They're amazing. And Shelley Long, trying to prove that the true Beverly Hills can do it, says, well, we'll sell 2,000. And Velda's like, sure you will. And I do appreciate that, you know, Shelley Long has a meeting with all the parents.
Mm.
And Jackie Collins' parent says, well, why don't we just buy them? Mm. And Shelley Long's like, because I thought about that and it is completely missing the point. The girls actually need to, like, learn industriousness.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they sidestepped that because that is the obvious solution to that problem.
Right.
And I'm glad that they addressed it directly. And I think the audience needs to hear that because if you're just thinking about solving the problem, you're missing the point of the movie, which is about actually learning valuable lessons wherever you can find them, even if you're in a weird position in life.
Well, and also letting the kids solve the problems.
Yeah. So
how do they solve the problems? They do telethons.
Yeah,
street performances.
Yep, Cookie Time. Classic song from True Beverly Hills. Actually, True Beverly Hills is a pretty dang good soundtrack, actually. It's very 80s, but it's very charming. I forgot to mention one of the kids in the Wilderness Girls, a young Carla Gugino.
That's right.
Yeah.
Blink and you'll miss her, but one of the girls from the other troops is Tori Spelling.
Yeah. You would think we'd be in the troop Beverly Hills, actually, considering she's Aaron Spelling's daughter and feels autobiographical in some way. But anyway, they end up selling 4,000 boxes, which, of course, is quite good. But in the end, Velda once again throws it back in their face. You're not really Girl Scouts, are you? You're not actually doing the thing. And
we're doing it. We're just doing it unconventionally. How dare you reject our unconventional solution to your old world problem?
And to be fair, Velda's boss is like totally seeing it Shelley Long's way, but Velda just resents everything about her. And she sent her underling, played by the great Mary Gross.
Mary Gross, who I remember from the movie Feds.
Yeah, that was a big hit for Feds. It was a reasonable hit, wasn't it? With her and Rebecca De Mornay, they were like the first female FBI students.
It's incredible. I imagine it's aged incredibly poorly, but I haven't seen it for quite some time. Yeah. But yeah.
She was in everything for a little while. She was in Baby Boom and Big Business, The Santa Claus, Practical Magic. I always liked her. So she plays Betty Thomas's henchwoman, who, of course, is actually not all that bad. And the more time she spends with Shelley Long, the more she realizes that Shelley Long is actually a decent person in Velda. Mm-hmm. Even though she may not be the wealthy person in the movie, she's actually not very nice.
Yeah.
It's all supposed to culminate in a big sort of wilderness hike full of obstacle course things. And basically the whole idea is Shelley Long has been supposed to have been teaching survival skills so that they can succeed at this sort of Double Dare Nickelodeon challenge that they're all supposed to do at the end. And Shelley Long just becomes worried all of a sudden that she has actually failed these kids and they won't be able to do what they have to do. And maybe she sucks. And that's their long, dark tea time of the soul.
And this was a really common story trope in film comedies of the 1980s to culminate everything with a contest.
Yeah.
Competition of some sort. In fact, that's the exact same structure as Revenge of the Nerds, which is directed by Jeff Canoe, who also did True Beverly Hills.
It was also in Meatballs.
It was an element of Animal House. It was a big...
Rad was about that as well. And it's basically just... We want to up the stakes at the end of a comedy, and creating some form of direct competition makes sense. It makes perfect sense if it's
to bring it up. It's The Wizard again.
There you go. It makes perfect sense if it's a sports movie to begin with, like the Bad News Bears. But if it's not, just throwing it in the last act is weird,
incredibly contrived, where everything is necessarily going to come together in a very contrived sort of way.
My favorite one of these is from the movie Airborne. You ever see Airborne?
Oh, where what was it called? Like The Devil's Spine or something?
Yeah, it's called The Devil's Backbone.
The Devil's Backbone.
It's got nothing to do with the Guillermo del Toro movie. But Airborne is one of the most 90s movies of the 90s. It's about a surfer kid who is forced to move to the Midwest where there is no surf, dude. And
Justin Whalen, was it?
Was it?
The lead actor? Or?
No, because that was the dude from Dungeons & Dragons, wasn't it?
Yeah, wasn't it the same guy?
It wasn't him. He looked more like Ryder Strong than that guy, but it wasn't Ryder Strong. so he's this, like, ultimate, like, Zen surfer bro, and he moves to the Midwest and there's a group of like Midwest hockey dudes who hate him, one of whom is played by a young Jack Black. And it's basically the whole thing is people don't like him, people don't like him, everyone's wearing 90s clothes, everyone's wearing 90s clothes. And then in the last act, we have to have the most awesome rollerblade race in the history of cinema.
We have to skate down this very, very long, very steep downhill slope.
It comes out of nowhere and solves nothing, but it's actually shot really cool. Mm. Like, it's... I like that movie, even though it's hopelessly dated, because, like, you're watching it, it's like, oh, what an interesting relic. Shit, that's a good race. Mm. That's just a well-filmed race sequence. That's, like, really badass, actually. Like,
True Beverly Hills doesn't have that kind of dynamic action, no. And in fact, the big climactic suspense sequence is walking across a log. And it's... and you could tell they didn't have sort of the budget or the time or the production value to make something that looked like large and dangerous. It's like someplace down in Topanga Canyon. Like, yeah. They just went out into the wilderness.
Oh, yeah, it's very clearly...
They put out
a
log. I
do appreciate that it's clearly L.A.
It's very clearly Southern California.
Where you would camp in L.A. is not where you would camp in, like, a Friday the 13th movie where it's New England and it's green. Mm. No.
No,
it's... it looks like really crappy, actually.
And they do talk about rattlesnakes, which are local. It's all about how, oh no, that you might slip off that log and fall. It's a long way down. It's like 10 feet.
Yeah, you could sprain something.
You could hurt yourself.
Yeah, but you want to slip.
It's not life or death. It's not clearly dangerous.
Yeah.
It's not as dangerous as the film is trying to have us believe it is.
No, but that's about as far as the stakes can go here. And it all culminates when... Velda is injured, not horribly, but injured, but she has trained her Red Feather scout troop that winning is the only thing that matters, so they immediately abandon her as dead weight. Mm. And Shelley Long's crew, and they've basically wagered that they have to win this thing. Shelley Long's crew is the only one that actually, like, stops to help her. Because even though she's terrible, she's still a human being, and they've learned a valuable lesson that everyone is a human being and deserves to be cared for. And so they end up dragging her along with them. And isn't it like the same gag at the end of Monsters University where the Red Feathers get there first, but they didn't bring their whole crew, so they lost?
That's right. Yeah.
And that's a good message, too. Like, oh, you lost. Yeah, you really should have read those rules.
Because they left a teammate behind, and that's not in the spirit of the thing.
Exactly. And so it all ends really happily, and everyone's super cheerful, and Craig T. Nelson and Shelley Long get back together. And it's adorable! I love this movie! I've seen this movie so many times. It's charming.
And there's a bunch of celebrity cameos. They're selling boxes of cookies door-to-door, and they stop at Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's house.
Yep.
Who, I guess you might not know who he is anymore, but he was like...
I think people know. Please tell me people know who Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is. One of the greatest football players.
I guess you don't know who he is. He was one of the LA Lakers.
He was one of the greatest basketball players of all time. He was also the co-pilot in the movie Airplane. Mm. And the doomsayer in the TV miniseries of this, The Stand, the
That's
original
right.
TV
yeah.
miniseries.
Not much of an actor, he'd probably agree.
Good presence, he's funny. He shows up.
Cheech shows up as himself, which is a little bizarre.
And he gets
at a rich person's party.
He gets to be like one of several, like once Mary Gross comes out of her shell. Mm-hmm.
She's a lot more confident, and people are attracted to her now.
Yeah, and now all of a sudden, like, people are, like, really interested in her. And Cheech Marin is one of the first people to notice, like, wow, you're really attractive. And what's his name? Who was the guy who... Remember Married with Children? They had next-door neighbors, and then the husband of the next-door neighbor left halfway through the show and was replaced by...
Oh, like a young, hunky guy,
like,
right?
The guy who was, like, the bad guy in Revenge of the Nerds 2. Remember?
I don't. There's not a lot I remember about Revenge of the Nerds.
He had 80 sleazeball written all over him. I think he shows up again as someone else who's trying to romance Mary Groves, and good for her. Mm. There's so many. Joyce Brothers shows up. Mm. There's this one hilarious bit where all of a sudden, like, they're selling cookies, and then all of a sudden, close up on Robin Leach, the Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous guy, and he just announces, "Ladies and gentlemen, Pia Zadora."
That's right, and Pia Zadora comes out.
Pia Zadora. You can get Pia Zadora in your movie.
Not a challenge.
In the late 80s, you could get Pia Zadora.
Get Pia Zadora now. She'll do it.
But my point is that the brief moment where maybe you couldn't get Pia Zadora was over between like 82 and 84.
fair.
Yeah. So there's a lot of Beverly Hills cameos. It's very knowing about the actual environment in which it is set, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, it it's as somebody watching this for the first time in 2021, it's some of its economic politics don't really read quite as well as perhaps they might have. This
true.
Deep sympathy and humanity that we're trying to sort of force onto the ultra rich is something that seems a little naive now.
Shouldn't you feel bad for the rich? And I'm like, maybe for how disassociated they can become. Mm. And it's easy to feel bad. And I think the whole point of the movie is it's easy to feel bad for the rich people's kids who are being raised in an environment which is very divorced from the experience of most children. And that's bound to feel alienating. Yeah. That's true. That's a fair point. You're not wrong.
But this film walks a really interesting line because the rich are buffoons, but they're also very sympathetic. And that's tough to pull off. And I think Shelley Long is one of the great reasons it works. Mm. Because she's able to play this kind of very clueless character, but who's also very honest. I feel about her the same way I feel about a character like Ernest P. Worrell. Mm. Ernest P. Worrell's a boob. He's also a klutz, and he's very destructive, but
you love him.
You gotta admit, you kind of like Ernest just because he's a good guy and he's always trying to help. And he's actually very sympathetic to the. He's
very sincere and he's very.
The name is appropriate.
Yeah, he actually cares about people.
He doesn't hate a lot. He's actually very welcoming of all people.
When he hurts people, it's because he was trying to help them. Yeah, and it's hard to be mad about that. And I think that's true for a lot of the things Shelley Long did. And I think this is definitely one of her better roles. I have a question for you. There is arguably, I would say, the greatest article ever written on the internet. And it was an article in which someone ranked every single outfit Shelley Long wears in True Beverly Hills. Every single new scene you see Shelley Long in, she's wearing a completely different outfit. And the outfits range from, actually that's quite stylish, to that is unbelievably absurd. And I love all of these outfits. And I'm curious, which outfit or outfits made the biggest impression on you? Mm.
She's wearing an outfit early in the movie where she is wearing. I'm not a fashion guy, so I apologize. But it's the sort of like cinching corset that has like a bustle attached to it.
Well, it flares out to the side, but not all around in a circle. Like there's a name for that, and I forget what that is. Yeah, and she looks like a tiered cake.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one.
That's awful.
But it's good, though.
Like, it's not something a human being should wear. Even Shelley Long, who's, very good physical comedian, is clearly not comfortable in it. And it's clearly, like, a parody of what fashion ought to look like.
Yeah. But that's, to be fair, that's a lot of high fashion is supposed to be pushing the boundaries of what fashion is capable of. Mm-hmm. And then that gets filtered down into something a little bit more practical.
Right. There's a speech about it in the film The Devil Wears Prada.
And it's a good speech. Mm-hmm. And it really clarifies if you've looked at like weird looking like fashion shows and going, who is that for? And it's like, it's there to be interesting and inspire people to do different things. And I feel like Shelley Long is playing the person who could actually afford the actual outfit. Mm. And I feel like that's the gag. Yeah. But I want to give credit where credit is due here. That article I was talking about is by Lindy West. It is on Jezebel. And it came out in 2014. Mm. And it's still the greatest article I've ever read on the internet. In any case. So final thoughts on True Beverly Hills before we move on. Because this is your first time watching. Right. And I'm clearly a fan.
It's a puffball, it's a comedy that's supposed to be really appropriate for little kids. I probably would have liked it a lot more had I seen it in 1989, back when comedies were a little bit more of an important centerpiece to a lot of the pop culture zeitgeist.
Yeah.
This was around the time I was watching films like Look Who's Talking and, Crocodile Dundee and comedy films that were really, really big hits. And so I would have been a little bit more conversant in that sort of comedy language because that's just where everything was at the time. Watching it now, it does feel sort of like a throwaway. It was one of the lesser films to come out of that era. But I appreciate Shelley Long a lot. And she brings enough heart to the movie that it actually does function rather than feel like something that's hopelessly out of date in terms of its views of wealth and the wealthy.
It's weird to me that Shelley Long's career wasn't bigger than it was. Like she had
her film career.
Yeah. She was a big sitcom star and then she left to focus on films and she had a couple of modest successes and then she just didn't after a while. And She was always reliable. She was always funny. She was always talented in everything that she did. And I just feel like she should have been a huge star. Like a huge, huge, huge star. Mm. And she was briefly, and it just didn't last, and it should have lasted. Yeah. I've always been a fan, and yeah. Mm. Anyway, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad this wasn't something that ended up hurting you. Sometimes,
no.
Sometimes sometimes things age poorly, and I'm glad this one held up and that you were able to enjoy it too. My first time watch, however.
This is a movie I had seen before. And now I've watched it twice. I've seen this movie as much as I've seen Return of the Jedi.
Jesus Christ, Whitney. We're going to talk about a film.
We're going to talk about a 1990 film directed by Stan Winston. 1 year has passed since Troop Beverly Hills, and the world has fallen apart.
We're going to be talking about a gnome named Gnorm.
He's an L.A. cop. He's a gnome. Right, a gnome. He's hot on the trail of $1 million. He's after
Lumen!
Right. Meet Gallagher and Gnorm. Two guys with nothing in common.
Giant opals.
Well, almost nothing.
Take it easy, will you? You gotta concentrate.
They've got to work together and get it together before everything blows apart. Upworld. The normal, it's Gnot.
Yeah, it's a gnome named Gnorm.
A gnome named Gnorm, also known as Upworld.
Because eventually they realized that was a stupid name.
Yeah. Gnome named Gnorm is a cop movie cum E.T. knockoff, where the E.T. is a gnome.
Yeah.
And the gnomes in this universe are underground dwellers. They live in caves. They dress like little hobos. Got like leather clothes and gunny sacks.
And pockets full of bones and... I think you hit the nail on the head, though, because, like, oftentimes there's a hit movie and people try to copy it. Mm. Okay, it's E.T. Okay, we'll do E.T., but with a different kind of creature. Okay, fine. And then we'll do, buddy cop movies are in. Well, we'll do a buddy cop movie, but...
With that E.T. creature.
But, so this is, that's the gag. It's two things. It's E.T. meets 48 Hours. That is not a good pitch.
That's a bad elevator pitch.
Every time I've seen that level, I've seen weird buddy cop stories work. There was a really good, we did a whole series on Cancel Too Soon once, like a whole month, where we talked about movies where there was a human cop and their robot partner. Mm. And there were a couple of really good ones, especially Almost Human. Starring Michael Ealy. That one kicked ass, actually. That was awesome.
It was a really good show. It was really really well written.
There was one
just
from,
too expensive to survive.
There was one from the early 90s starring Yancey Butler, which was surprisingly good, called Man and Machine, but it's M-A-N-N because the human cop was named Man. Get it? But it was actually pretty well written, and Yancey Butler really carried it well. But most of the time when I've seen people try to do, an inhuman... or monstrous type of cop partner, it sucks. I've never seen all of Theodore Rex, where Whoopi Goldberg was a human cop, and her partner was a tiny Tyrannosaurus that was the size of a very, like a very big person.
But it looks like that TV show Dinosaurs, like it had big cartoon eyes. And,
It was basically Who Framed Roger Rabbit, except instead of cartoons living, alongside... like human people, it was dinosaurs.
Human-sized dinosaurs.
Human-sized dinosaurs. Not like a big T-Rex walking around going, hey, how's it going?
It was even tried in that movie, Bright. The human cop and troll orc. I think it was an orc partner in a fantasy universe.
The thing with cop comedies is that cops aren't funny usually. Mm. They end up having to deal with really severe situations that aren't necessarily prone to humor, and if you're not willing to go dark with it, you're usually clearly glossing over the real story. Or if you make it too dark, you can't be cute and funny anymore. Ironically, one of the few movies that I think did this right is a movie that everyone else hates, but I will stand by this. Stop or My Mom Will Shoot is not that bad. It's actually kind of funny. Mm. It's actually a good juxtaposition, and the actors in it understand the gag. But it's just really, really hard to pull off. So what we have here is a movie that on one hand is like a gritty cop movie where we see people get shot in the head. And on the other hand, it's a visual effects kids movie about an animatronic gnome, and that's how they insist that it's pronounced, that like runs around and like knocks things over and like spits in its hand, and it's all gross, and it's actually harasses Claudia Christian. And
oh, poor Claudia Christian. Claudia Christian does have a nice, long, healthy career. She was on a Babylon 5. She did okay.
I know, but she's into movies where she's...
She had to pay her dues.
Oh, my God.
She paid so many dues,
so much
respect
for Claudia Christian as an actor. She's so damn talented.
Did you ever see that movie Hexed? It was like it was kind of like a spoofish movie where it was about... it was sort of like a comedy version of Basic Instinct, where she played the vamp, and she was really good in that movie.
I'm looking at it right now. It looks familiar. I feel like I might have seen it, but it's the kind of thing that probably if I watched it, I'd recognize scenes.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure we rented that at least once. But yeah, I'm a big Claudia Christian fan. She's always a delight in everything she's in. Whitney and I will go to bat for the movie Arena any day of the week. But also The Hidden kicks ass.
Yeah, Claudia Christian went around. And this was another film where she's sort of paying her dues. She and Anthony Michael Hall are partners. And this is something that's taken from partly Police Academy, partly Lethal Weapon, where the Anthony Michael Hall cop character is wacky. And he dresses weird and has a wild apartment. And likes to do funny voices, and he's also averse to violence. He doesn't load his gun.
He's a little kid who is a cop, basically. Gets to wear silly clothes. He gets to, like, his apartment is filled with comic books. There's a scene where, like, they open up a drawer, and his drawer is filled with comic books at work, which is supposed to show that, like, he's really immature. But clearly he's been created to be a stand-in for kids in the audience.
Yeah.
So, like, he's a cop, but it's you. If you were a cop, 13-year-old child, and I'm like, we should not be cops. It's not a good plan. At the beginning of the movie, he has been selected by the chief of police, Jerry Orbach.
Pre-Law and Order Jerry Orbach.
Yep, around the same time,
A year before Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, he was also the voice of... It was Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast,
The Candlestick.
Yeah, that weirded me out the first time I heard that. Jerry Orbach was Lumiere.
Jerry Orbach was like a song and dance guy from Broadway.
I'm not singing fine. It's just the French accent threw me.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why that just... I couldn't imagine Jerry Orbach doing the voice. I couldn't see him doing it.
His voice acting is so good that you don't recognize that as Jerry Orbach.
He's brilliant. He's a wonderful actor. Jerry Orbach, the late, sadly, no longer with us, Jerry Orbach, amazingly wonderful character actor, brought dignity to almost everything he did. He's in this movie. No one can help him. He's on his own here, and he does the best he can. But he's enlisted Anthony Michael Hall to be the undercover guy, and they're making an exchange, for stolen jewels, basically. Mm. And while in the middle of the exchange, Anthony Michael Hall is knocked unconscious, the person who is making the exchange with the jewels gets blown up, which is really violent, and the gnome, whose name is Gnorm,
has just come to the surface at that exact moment.
Yeah, because...
In a public park.
Because, and this is something that they take way too long to explain. It's not that important. Here's how it works. In the underground gnome city, their source of power is called a lumen. And it's basically a solar battery, but it's like a jewel.
Magical MacGuffin.
It's a magical MacGuffin, but it needs to be recharged every so often by a gnome taking the dangerous trip to the surface, or as they call it, upworld, to basically charge it in the sun. There's a moment where, like, Gnorm is like, where is the sun? And I'm like, you're in Southern California. It's fucking it's not that smoggy. You can get there. Like, the end of the movie, when they finally charge the dang thing, they had shot, like, Anthony Michael Hall climbing a tree to get closer to the sun. Mm. And it's not good absurd. It's just stupid absurd.
I don't know who played the voice of Gnorm. And whenever they showed Gnorm in long shots, it was always like... it was mostly an animatronic. Sometimes it was like a rod puppet. And sometimes it was somewhat in a suit that had like servos in the face to make it operate. while the I feel about the Gnorm mask the way I feel about the Howard the Duck mask, in that it's expressive, but not in a way you want to see.
No.
It's really unappealing to look at.
Sometimes.
Its teeth show in this really unnatural way.
Sometimes the eyes move in a way that's not like the eyes moving. It's like they suddenly like get bulbous and bulge in a way that's like really off-putting and gross.
It's a really unappealing looking creature.
And what's weird is that this was directed by Stan Winston. Now, if you don't know the name, you know his work. Stan Winston was a visual effects and creature effects artist who worked on such films as Aliens, Predator, Terminator 2, Edward Scissorhands, Jurassic Park, AI, Artificial Intelligence, The Thing, Iron Man. Like, he's one of the legends of practical visual effects. He made the monsters that we love. He made the heroes that we love. He made the robots that we love. His first film that he directed was a horror movie called Pumpkinhead, which is not a, some people will fight me on this. I don't think it's a particularly good movie, but it's a perfectly fine movie.
More than anything, the monster is really cool looking.
Yeah, Lance Henriksen plays a guy who's a child, is run over by a bunch of drunken teenagers, if I'm remembering it correctly. And he's so overcome with grief that he basically makes a deal with the devil and goes through this weird arcane ritual to raise a demonic pumpkin creature to exact violent revenge. The monster looks amazing. Yeah. The story is very simple, I think, to a fault, but it gets you there. It's worth it to see the monster. Stan Winston clearly put effort into the monster. You would think that even if the script wasn't good, the gnome in A Gnome Named Gnorm would be worth it. We'd be like, oh, well, at least you gotta admit, Gnorm looked awesome, right? Gnorm looks terrible.
Yeah.
Even for the era, he looks terrible. He's off-putting. He's got hair and like these weird, ugly wisps. Like, his eyes are violent sometimes. Like, there's this there's this part where he's like in the back seat of a car and he's trying to kill Jerry Orbach, and it's right out of the movie Child's Play. It's right at that scene where Chris Sarandon's fighting Chucky. Chucky's trying to strangle him in the back seat. It's that scene, and it's as scary or scarier because Gnorm is terrifying.
They're clearly trying to go for something like Peter Froud was the name of the designer who did the creatures in The Dark Crystal.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of like fantasy paintings with these really kind of strange-looking creatures. And I think that's kind of the design they were going for, something a little bit more earthy and earthen with a sort of distended face.
Yeah.
But it fails.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any kind of wonderment or like practicality. It doesn't move in a natural sort of way. When we see long shots of the gnome's full body, it looks like it can't stand up. Like, it doesn't look like a creature.
There's a scene in the movie where they strip search the gnome, and they we go through this scene. This is not off camera. Like, we don't see full Gnorm, but they make a point of showing how like weird and violating this is. Why? Is that you wanted to show off your puppet? Like, no, don't do this. Why are you doing this to us or Gnorm? That's as far as my sympathy goes for Gnorm. I don't like Gnorm as a character. He's gross and off-putting and weirdly sexist. He has a lot of really like untoward things to say about Claudia Christian.
And he explains, in fact, that even though this lumen needs to be charged up, he was doing it out of schedule. Like, he just sort of did it without anybody asking him because he wanted to impress a gnome girlfriend.
Who is apparently very shallow and only likes warriors, and Gnorm is merely a tunneler.
Look, we don't know about gnome society.
What a great mythology we've created. Thanks to Gnome and Gnorm. But basically, the plot ends up being Anthony Michael Hall has to find a way to communicate with Gnorm and find some way to form a bond and convince Claudia Christian that Gnorm is real, and then try to figure out how to get Gnorm on the... He's a witness to a murder. That's the plot of the movie.
The plot is a gnome witness to murder.
Yeah, and so he's got to figure out a way to, like... And I'm like, how are you going to get him on the stand? He refuses to be, like, seen by other people, except half the time.
No,
when he just is.
I'll give a gnome named Gnorm this much. Anthony Michael Hall is so game.
Yeah.
Anthony Michael Hall is actually a very energetic actor, and he's quite good, too. And he's continued to work. If you've ever seen his work on The Dead Zone,
he's actually pretty good.
He brought a lot of necessary wrath to a movie like Freddy Got Fingered, where it's just sort of... He's like the only character in that movie who behaves like a human, which is saying a lot.
I've actually never seen that movie.
Oh, God, it is execrable. it's worse than you've heard. Like, it is unbelievably bad. I think...
And somehow that doesn't make me want to see it. Like, usually that would. I don't...
Like, Roger Ebert, in his review of Freddy Got Fingered, said, "The day may come when this is seen as some sort of weird neo-surrealist masterpiece," and some people actually describe it that way.
Yeah, I know.
But he also says, "The day will never come when people describe it as funny." Some people do think that it's like this weird work of, like, broad satire, and I can see how it functions that way, but it's so off-putting, it's difficult to absorb the message.
Yeah.
Anthony Michael Hall is at least looking at this disgusting-looking gnome puppet and trying to behave like a real human being around it.
Yeah.
And trying to interact with it on a real level in ways that the other actors aren't.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who are turning in cartoon performances.
And he's playing a very broad character, Anthony Michael Hall. But he's at least trying to bring some kind of actual humanity and functionality to this movie.
You know who he is in this movie? And I think this is a parallel I think newer audiences, younger audiences might be able to appreciate. James Marsden.
There you go. He's James Marsden opposite Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, or that rabbit or whatever. Like, he's giving what he needs to give, and if the script isn't good, that's not his fault. I don't think Anthony Michael Hall's particularly amazing in this or anything, but you're right. He's being asked to act under weird duress. There's a weird bit in this movie. The villains in this movie... there's a secret villain, and spoiler alert, it's Jerry Orbach. There's no one else it could be. Jerry Orbach's a bad guy. But before then, we have two other villains.
Yeah, there's a bad guy named Zadar.
And then there's another bad guy played by Robert Zadar.
Who does not play the character of Zadar, but his real name is Zadar.
And he has to talk to a guy named Zadar a lot and say the name Zadar. It's weird. It is a weird... I don't know if it's a meta joke... Or what? I don't. Maybe he was originally supposed to play Zadar, but then they decided to switch roles for some weird reason. I don't get it. Robert Zadar, if you're unfamiliar with him, he's no longer with us, sadly. Very fun character actor. He was very distinctive, and because he had a very pronounced jawline. So he typically played bruiser characters, like really big heavy guys.
Yeah, brutes and heavies, yeah.
He was one of the bad guys in Tango and Cash. He was the titular maniac cop in the Maniac Cop movies. Mm. Good movies, by the way. I was always a fan. Even though he wasn't a particularly good actor, you could always tell he was having fun.
Yeah.
It was just like, I get to be in a movie today. Like, that kind of enthusiasm. Like, he's always... having a good time.
I like Robert Zadar a lot.
Same.
Because he will do like these trash movies, and he'll be there.
Yeah.
He'll show up on the set.
He'll give as much to a little movie as to a big movie, and you gotta love that kind of commitment.
I would never describe him as a great actor, but he is an actor. He plays different parts, but he's in a lot of just total crap.
There's this weird bit where he encounters Anthony Michael Hall and Gnorm, and they don't really sell the joke very well, but I guess he's like really nearsighted, so he doesn't see anything weird about Gnorm. He thinks Gnorm is a child. And Anthony Michael Hall is this cop who is taking a child with him to like fight bad guys, and he actually like stops in the middle of a fight and gives Anthony Michael Hall a lecture about being a better parent. And I'm like, you know, maybe that's why they switch characters and you're not playing Zadar, man. You just wanted this fun speech. It's so good for you.
I would love to have seen him play, like, multiple characters and they all look like Robert Zadar. He's very distinct looking. This is a world where a bunch of people just happen to look exactly like Robert Zadar.
The Zadar triplets. Have them all.
You know what? I recently saw Robert Zadar in Cherry 2000, which I saw for the first time recently.
Oh, you only just saw that for the first time?
Yeah.
That movie's pretty fun, isn't it?
It's pretty fun.
It's very kooky. If you've never seen Cherry 2000, we'll take a side here, because apparently we're not going to do it here because Whitney's seen it. It's one of my faves. Mm-hmm. Cherry 2000 takes place in the near future where... first off, it's like a post-apocalypse, because of course it is. But also, like, human, like, sexual interaction has turned into something that is so bureaucratic.
It's super, super commodified. Yeah. And
yeah, people go to singles bars with their lawyers, and their lawyers negotiate a first date. And Fishburne plays one of the lawyers, by the way. It's really funny.
It's clearly a reaction to the AIDS crisis.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah. And it's... It fits. It makes sense. This is an extrapolation of where we think things are going in the 80s. So the protagonist of the film isn't interested in dating human beings. He has a sex doll, but it's the future, and his sex doll is
a complicated android.
A completely lifelike robot. At the beginning of the movie, the robot malfunctions, and so he has to travel into the hazardous wastes in order to find a replacement like computer chip to fix his sex bot. Mm. And in order to do that, he hires a badass tracker played by Melanie Griffith, who helps him fight off wave after wave of self-help 80s cultists in order to fix his sex bot. Yeah. That's an awesome fucking movie.
It's actually very critical of a lot of the trends that were big in the 1980s.
Yeah.
A scene where he goes into like a Baghdad cafe, like the sort of like really run down hotel out on the edge of town, and Robert Zadar is just in it. He's just sort of wandering around in it, and I don't think maybe he has a line of dialogue. And then he just wanders off.
This is from the set. Cherry 2000 was from the same director as Steve DeJarnatt, who had also directed Miracle Mile, which is, I think, gradually, steadily being considered like this cult masterpiece of the 80s. So if you've seen Miracle Mile and you never saw Cherry 2000, see Cherry 2000. Mm-hmm. And if you've never seen Cherry 2000 at all, see Cherry 2000. Well, it's really neat.
In fact, just run down Robert Zadar's filmography, because you'll run into a lot of interesting stuff. You'll find Samurai Cop.
Yeah, that's a fun
movie. Samurai Cop is...
One of the best bad movies ever.
Really one of the best bad movies
I don't like usually using that term, like, so bad it's good, because in my estimation, if I'm enjoying it, it must be doing something right. Samurai Cop is clearly doing many things wrong. It's clearly a work of incompetence, but it's still very fun.
I put it this way. A film can be very, very bad and still be entertaining. Mm. And both of those things can be true.
I guess my point is, as a critic, if I'm enjoying it, I need to be able to explain why. And simply saying it's so bad it's good feels like a cheat. I need to be able to go deeper than that.
If you see a film that's incredibly bad, but you are sort of rolling with its goofy earnestness and are enjoying sort of how clueless it is, then you can say that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Samurai Cop is an incredibly clueless movie. It was made by a guy named Amir Shirvan. Mm-hmm. He made three high profile.
They
had budgets of $150 a piece, but these sort of cop movie knockoffs, and one of them is Samurai Cop, and that's become sort of became a big midnight movie phenomenon for a short while.
You can tell how much we really don't like talking about a gnome named Gnorm, because very long tangent.
This falls in line with the Robert Zadar career. He plays a supporting character in this, where he doesn't play the character named Zadar, where he gets to give a speech to Anthony Michael Hall about how irresponsible it is to bring a gnome on police raids. Okay, you know what? There's something kind of strange about this.
Yeah.
A gnome named Gnorm is not fun to watch.
No, it's really hurtful, actually. People talk about, like, oh, why are critics, like, so mean to movies? And sometimes critics are just jerks, just like anyone is. Yeah. But
movies sometimes
hurt us. Yeah. Like, we go into a movie, and as anyone does, and we're opening ourselves up to an experience. We're giving you our trust. And we're saying, please, show us whatever you want. And if you show something that hurts us, that makes us really wish we weren't here, that offends our sensibilities, that we find simply grotesque, and then we can't find any meaningful justification for why it's like this, and it just is a really unpleasant thing to sit through, and we have to sit through the whole thing, and we have to keep hoping that maybe it'll get better, and it never does. Yeah, we're hurt. We might lash out a little bit. I'm not saying it's mature, but sometimes it happens. And a gnome named Gnorm is really pushing the fucking limits. There's so many things in this movie that I should at least be amused by. At least the fact of their existence. And instead, I hate them.
Yeah.
I just hate them.
There's not a moment where you feel like, oh, they did that well.
Yeah.
Or that's wonderfully strange.
Yeah.
they're selling it so straight, and the direction is so bland, and the special effect is on Gnorm is so bad, and the concept is so bad that you're never at a moment where you can say, this is okay.
Yeah.
I'm fine with the idea here.
The best I can do is pity the actors.
Yeah.
I pity Anthony Michael Hall, I pity Claudia Christian, I really pity Jerry Orbach. These are people who are really trying to make a movie out of this, and the material fails them. I would love to hear an oral history on a gnome named Gnorm, because my theory, and just a theory, I don't have a lot of good behind-the-scenes info on this, is what probably happened here was a movie where different people making it, director, writer, producers, studio, whoever had enough clout to put their hand on the screenplay, had different ideas about who it should be for. Because clearly there's a little kid element here. Because the protagonist is a very goofy and childlike, because it's a very childlike premise. There's that element of E.T., imagination on wonder. Fine. But it's also clearly intended for older audiences, because people get shot in the head.
It's a little bit more ribald. Well, violence was sold to kids a lot more aggressively.
This is clearly not for little kids.
No, but
this
is
clearly for like
you look at the blockbuster, PG-13 rated blockbusters now, and they're incredibly violent. But it's a bloodless violence. Mm-hmm. It's people beating up on robots. Yeah. It's violent, but it's less violent than it used to be. And you go back a generation, and the violence... Kids were going to see more violent movies more regularly, I think.
I realize that. My point is that I don't feel like...
more violent movies were being made.
I think the fact that PG movies or PG-13 movies aired a little bit more on violence, even in movies that were for kids, I think the movies that pulled that off, the movies that were good within that dynamic, had to walk a tightrope. I think you look at the movies like Gremlins or Gremlins 2, for example, which are clearly movies that appeal to adults and have really dark elements, but also have, again, childlike wonder. You really need to know where not to cross a line. You really need to know how to keep adults invested while still keeping small children who aren't really getting all of the subtext or some of the in-jokes. You need to find a way to keep them all invested here. And it feels like a gnome named Gnorm is trying to be appealing to older audiences, at least like middle schoolers and teenagers, with a little bit more action, a little bit more ogling, which is... immature and inappropriate, but it's in there, and like that's clearly not for little kids. But they also want to have spitty jokes, like, oh, we're spitting in our hands and we're touching each other, and that's how we shake hands on things, isn't that? That's a little kid joke. That's not a joke that adults are going to be like, charming. Like, and ultimately, their attempt to appeal to both types of audiences, older and younger, always falls on the lowest common denominator. Yeah. And so the only, like, target demo I can think of for this movie are, like, 13-year-old gross kids who really liked the Garbage Pail Kids movie.
Yeah. No, 1990 was the year I turned 12.
Okay.
Had I staggered into a theater and seen a gnome named Gnorm...
Why were you staggering at 12? I had so many pixie sticks.
too many gummy worms. This was the era when I was like pleading, because my mom wouldn't take me to whatever movie I wanted to see, but my dad would. And so I would plead with my father to take me to see whatever goofy ass comedy had come out that week. So he took me to see films like Young Einstein and Spaced Invaders.
I liked Space Invaders.
It's been a while since I've seen them.
But there's stuff in that movie I really like.
All I'll say is my father is a hero. And had I, like, had a gnome named Gnorm caught my attention, I probably would have seen it at age 12 and might have some vaguely positive memories of it. I was a fool.
Yeah, this is not a a weird, wonderful cult film that's just waiting to be rediscovered. No, it's a bad cult film that's waiting to be buried. Like, yeah, it's just like, please let me die. No, we're putting you on Tubi. No!
Yeah, it's a sick little oddity that is made for mockery while you and your friends are drunk.
Yeah, I just, there's...
But not 12. You're over 21 and you're drunk.
There's just nothing to recommend about it. It's such a bad film.
It's just a bad film. It's not enjoyable.
Yeah, and thank you for making us watch it, patrons. That is it for the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you want to vote for the next episode of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, head on over to our Patreon page. Patreon.com/Critically Acclaimed Network. Only $1 a month. You get bonus podcasts. You get our Holy Batman podcast. We review every single episode of the 1960s Batman show. We also have back catalogs as well. That was where our Firefly podcast was. You can listen to that too. And you also get to vote in all our various polls. And you get to vote every week for the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club film. And next week, your options all hail from HBO Max. And we decided that since this was... this is some 80s nostalgia stuff. Well, we decided to go classy next week. So it's going to be dramas on HBO Max. And the nominees are, vote for whichever one you would like us to review, East of Eden, one of only three films ever starring James Dean. Like Water for Chocolate, indie hit, celebrated film from the 90s. The Sugarland Express, Steven Spielberg's first theatrically released film, unless you count Duel, which is kind of iffy. Like, it was released theatrically some places, but not. It's not a film people talk about a lot. And Love Story, which was a, to use your words, staggeringly popular tragic romance from the 1970s. It was a gigantic blockbuster, and for the most part, people don't talk about it very much anymore. And it'd be interesting to see how it holds up. I've never seen it. I'll tell you that one right now. And that's what's coming up on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Head on over to our Patreon if you want to help out the show. Big, big special thank you to all of our patrons, not just for choosing the films for this week, but also for keeping this show and all of our other programming afloat. We wouldn't be here without you. That's just a fact. So thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. If you want to join in the conversation, there's a couple of ways to do it. You can head on over to Twitter, follow us at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I am at Whitney Seibold.
We have an email address. It's letters at criticallyacclaimed.net. You want to talk about the movies that we discussed this week, a topic that we broached, something we mentioned in other podcasts, ask us a question, ask us for recommendations, take us to task or something. That's the best place to do it. Send us an email. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. And we also have a P.O. box people who like to send us snail mail. People have asked, and so we have it now. Tell us what it is.
Do we even call it snail mail anymore?
I do.
All right. It is the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Love to hear from you. And you know, head on over to our Salt Cat Soap Store. The Salt Cat Soap Store is actually going on hiatus for a couple of days this week. While I take, along with my wife and partner, Michelle, our first vacation in like 5 years.
Long, long time.
It's been 5 years. So we're going away for like 3.5 days. But when we come back, we're coming back really, really strong with a lot of new soap products for the month of June. It's Pride Month. We got a lot of cool Pride soaps. We have a soap that I have designed that is based off my memories of my childhood. Which I'm very excited to talk about. And all of that will be debuting this Saturday. It's first Saturday of the month is when we debut our new line of soaps every single month. So that's Etsy. Go to Etsy.com and look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. Or you can follow us at Salt Cat Soap on Instagram or Twitter. And if you want more of Whitney talking about movies you might not have heard of, make sure you listen to his other podcast.
Yeah, over on the Screens Margins Network, hosted by the venerable B. Peterson, they and I are discussing films on Ovid, which is the streaming service for sort of deep cut art house lunatics.
If you
like
think
me.
The Criterion Channel is way too mainstream.
Yeah, if the Criterion Channel is like, oh, everybody's seen those movies, and you know those are arch and easy to consume, go over to Ovid and you can find something that's a little bit more challenging. And Golly, it's been such a breath of fresh air. But B and I have done 3 episodes so far, and we're going to continue talking about just whatever we happen to catch on Ovid. The name of the podcast is All About Ovid, spelled with all O's. Isn't that cute?
You see what I did.
So yeah, I'll go over to the Screen's Margins, hosted by B. Peterson, and you can watch They and I. Watch. You can listen to They and I talk about all of the greatest films that we watched that week on Ovid.
Nice. Yeah. All right. So we can't tell you what we're watching next week, but we will find out pretty soon on the Patreon page. So once again, you can vote at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you everybody for joining us on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. And until next time, the streamers are done, man. I don't know how we're gonna end this. It's fine.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.